story has gang warfare, violence, sex, drugs, and political corruption. It stretches from New York City to Vancouver's Chinatown to Macau to Cambodia to the Philippines. It's the story told in Paper Fan, the hunt for triad gangster Stephen Wan. The riveting story told in Paper Fan is the decade-long chase that the author Terry Gold embarks on as he tries to find Stephen Wan, who supposedly died in 1992. Terry Gold is an investigative journalist and an internationally best-selling author. He's won 38 awards and honors for his writing on organized crime and social issues. He has appeared on such programs as 2020 and 48 Hours. He joins us to talk about Stephen Wan, whom he befriended in the course of his work, as well as a Paper Fan, recently published in trade paperback by Vintage, a division of Random House Canada, $22 Canadian, $15.50 American. Please welcome to thecommentary.ca Terry Gould. Good morning, Mr. Gould.
Good morning, Jess.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've gone from reporting this story in Saturday Night and elsewhere to being a part of it in this book. That's what I gather from reading it. You've traveled a lot. Talk to me about who Stephen Gould, who Stephen Wan was, or is, and what drew you to him.
Yeah, Steve was born in Hong Kong in 1964, and his parents sent him away to be raised in New York City with some relatives. And he was raised in an environment that at the time got him involved at a very, very early age with some very violent gangs, the Ghost Shadows gangs and the Flying Dragons. They dominated Chinatown during his formative years. And he worked at in a sweatshop. His relatives put him to work in the basement boxing beans. And he was an unhappy kid away from his family, and he saw these gangsters drift in and out of the shop, quite glamorous, with cars outside, and they seemed to float above consequences for all their actions. So at a very early age, what was imprinted on him was that the gang life could give him escape from his problems, could give him fellowship, money, and girls. Young men are always after girls, and that's one of the prime reasons a lot of dissatisfied and unhappy young guys wind up with gangs. The promise is there. His first arrest came as 11, and then his parents brought him back to Vancouver, and he very quickly joined the gang that was on top in those days, which was the Red Eagles gang. He moved up very quickly in the Red Eagles and was arrested for all kinds of gang fights and ruffian stuff, but as a juvenile, he never did any time for that. And he became a co-leader of the Red Eagles, and then at 21 years old, he went over to Hong Kong, and he became an initiated member of the 14K Triad. The Triads are roughly the equivalent of the Sicilian Mafia. They're a world, in Chinese terms, they're a worldwide organized crime group with many subgroups to it. But they float through society like water through tea bags. They are very, very well connected, take advantage of corruption in all the third world countries, operate basically out of all the Chinatowns throughout the world, and their catalog of crimes covers it all, from prostitution to piracy. I'm talking about ship piracy, drugs, extortion, people smuggling. And because they can so well take advantage of the corruption of officials there, they tend to operate almost as an international corporation, very much tied in with the operations of the very economies of those countries. And Steve eventually became an official in the Triads, and when he came back to Vancouver, and he founded his own gang called the Gumwa. And that's when his path and mine crossed. We're talking about the late 80s here, and it's a very, very violent gang. And accrued membership very, very quickly. Steve's tactics, he'd learned a lot in New York, and his tactics for recruitment were basically to have a few of his boys approach a very, very vulnerable new immigrant in the ESL program, beat him up for a few days. And then Steve would pull up in his fancy car, wave his arm, put a stop to the trouble, and invite the kid in, as if he was saving him from his torment, and then take him down to his pool room headquarters, and he'd ply him with all the things that had seduced him into the gangs, girls and free pool and drugs if he wanted it. And they'd put him on a minor crime here and there and reward him for it, and within a month, the kid started to see Steve as sort of his ticket out of his unhappy life in Canada, and he initiated the kid in his gang, and that kid's life was as good as lost. Now, I was teaching at the time in the center of all that stuff. There were gang wars going on between Steve's gang, the Gumois, and another gang called the Lotus, and another gang called the Via Ching, and yet another gang called the Los Diablos. And all this stuff was going on around me as I was teaching, and some of my students were members of Steve's enemies, the Lotus gang. And while little gangsters and even big ones, they don't necessarily talk about themselves, they will gossip about their enemies. In fact, police informant handlers at the very beginning of their careers learn very quickly that gang guys are not averse to taking out their enemies by informing on them.
Right.
It's easier than killing them. So these guys were filling me in on all these details about Steve, and I started looking into his career, and there was a whole catalog of crimes he was connected with, and his charges were either, we're talking about murder and drug dealing, credit card fraud and assault with grievous wounding, and his charges one after another were dismissed or stayed, and he was never convicted of a crime. He had no criminal record, and he had a very good lawyer at the time, and that was mayoralty candidate Harry Rankin.
Right.
Finally, Steve made a push to become the big gangster in town. He targeted a Lotus gang hangout in Chinatown called the Goldstone. And he walked in there and he precipitated with his boys, and he knew that they would react violently, and he precipitated a melee, and he smashed one of their enforcers' head in with a metal post right outside the restaurant publicly in front of hundreds of witnesses, and there was gunfire, and a bystander was shot, and two of Steve's guys were shot, and he was arrested for manslaughter that night, and as he did quite often, his lawyers successfully claimed self-defense, and he got off on that again. Now, the kid he killed was an ESL student, and this was after this had been going on for a long time, and I just said that, you know, somebody's got to do something about this guy, at least expose him in some way. So I went to CBC, and we decided to do an interview with him, and I knew a lot of his enemies, both in the police and in the gang world, and we were both from New York. And one of his enemies in California had asked me to pass a message on to him that he should stay away from San Francisco. And so I left messages on his pager and then went and knocked on his door. And he remembered me from all these messages, and I'd spoken to his lawyer, and he invited me in, and we actually had a rapport, both of us, you know, being from New York. I'm from New York, by the way. And he started talking around the subject of a lot of what he was doing, and we talked for about 2.5 hours, and then he brought up something very interesting. He said One of his connections was that his boss in Vancouver owned a bodyguard service, and he managed it. And this bodyguard service protected, met heroin dealers at the airport and guarded them around Vancouver while they did their business. And he mentioned that. And the police had no or very little information on that. And what Steve didn't know was that I was wearing a mic, and every word he said was being transmitted to a CBC van parked down the block, and that we had a telephoto lens glued to his living room window. And then we put it on the air. I hung around with Steve for about a month, and we got more information, and we actually kind of became friends, if you can consider
right.
the way we were both operating. He was trying to seduce me into his world, this guy who didn't have any trouble crossing borders and who could act as his publicist against the Lotus Gang. And I was trying to get as much information from him as I could. And under those circumstances, we were going around to massage parlors and eating out together and playing pool. Anyway, he got very upset when it was a two-part thing on CBC, and he showed up at the house at 3 in the morning, but he knocked.
Rather than shoot you.
Yeah, yeah, and he could have done, you know, there was a couple of reasons for that. One was that, and I had a prior knowledge of this, Chinese gangsters, Japanese gangsters, white gangsters, Jewish gangsters, they're very, very racist, very coarse people. Chinese gangsters are very racist to white people. They have a word for white people. It's called Jing Mao Ho. It means hairy monkey. And they literally consider us lower down, white people like myself, lower down on the evolutionary scale. And the motive for murder in the Chinese underworld is loss of face. Because I was a white guy, no matter the betrayal, that from Steve's point of view, I couldn't really cause him to lose face amongst his own peers. Therefore, he was just shocked that it happened. But it wasn't worth hiring, you know, just giving the word to somebody to come take me out to him. And so he just basically showed up at the house to vent.
But if you were a Chinese journalist, you probably would have had you killed.
Oh, yeah, I'd be dead, you know, 5 minutes after the thing was on television, or even maybe in the middle of the show.
So, hanging out with Stephen Wong, yeah. and then, but beyond that, knocking on his door and hanging out with him at his house,
yeah.
Were you at any point during that time scared at all for your own personal safety?
Yeah, I was, because I was wearing a mic, right?
Well, why do it then? Is it because he wanted to put an end to his career?
Well, what he was doing to the kids was terrible.
Right.
I mean, I was a teacher for a year, and these kids, this was during the era of the boat people, and these kids were very, very vulnerable, and they just broke your heart. You know, they were over here with relatives that sometimes their parents were dead, they'd been killed, they'd been in refugee camps. They were just like flayed figures with no psychological protection. And Steve, not alone in town, but he was the prime recruiter at the time. He was usually taking full advantage of these kids, and he recruited about 50 of them, and their lives were and are as good as lost. Very, very few of those kids ever recovered, and you could see it. You could watch them change as they went into his world or into the world of the gangs.
So suffice to say, after he visited you after the CBC report aired, you no longer were friends?
Well, what happened was I went under a six-month RCMP protection program.
I see.
In the middle of that, oddly enough, we had a rapprochement. There was a murder, I started to do a docudrama on it for CBC, and Steve got word I was doing a docudrama on it, and Steve was connected to that murder. And he figured that here I was working on him again, and I was going to prove it. So he actually gave me a call, and he said he wanted to talk with me. So I got together with him again.
Really?
But there were cops all over me at the time. It was actually safer than it was the first one. But what happened was, in the middle of that, about 3 weeks after the CBC documentary, Steve was raised pretty high on police priorities, and they set up a project against him called against his world called Project Bugs. They were trying to figure out the source of heroin on the downtown east side, and they're pretty sure he was behind it. And so they targeted him after they got some preliminary information, and it was a 6-month operation, and they finally nailed him, and he was looking at 18 to 20 years. All his co-conspirators were eventually found guilty and sentenced to heavy, heavy time, even in Vancouver, where they give light time for heroin trafficking. His number two man got 14 and a half years. Number three man got 7.5 years. And his number one guy, he was looking at 18, 20.
But in the course of that, he got his passport back and went on a vacation.
Well, yeah, what happened was he persuaded he took out over $1 million in life insurance. This is without the Mounties being aware of it. He persuaded a Supreme Court judge to give him back his passport. And he went over to the Philippines without the Mounties being aware of it. And he died in a remote area on an island called Negros. And comes back here. The ashes get shipped to Vancouver with a death certificate and fully documented by police and bureaucrats that this guy died in such and such a manner, and has his ashes. And the trial started. This was just before his trial was going to begin. And because he was officially dead, he was deemed, quote, non-compellable. He couldn't be made to. So the judge severed his case from his trial, and the trial went on without him. And there wasn't a cop around that didn't know that this was a staged death, or didn't strongly suspect it. But with no warrant, they couldn't investigate. They need a warrant to investigate something. So they basically weren't even allowed to phone the Philippines. Well, I got on the story. I got in touch with a National Bureau of Investigation over in the Philippines, found out a whole bunch of stuff. The trail that he supposedly died on, he couldn't manage to get up there in the vehicle that he said he had died in. The there were so many things that were on the. There was a cemetery his body was cremated over there, and it was a cemetery cremator. Never even signed the certificate. They forged a certificate. In fact, there was no crematorium.
That's
where
Mr. Menace, right?
Menace. They misspelled his name on the. Affidavit, right, when they forged his signature. So I went over there with some bodyguards that were supplied to me by the insurance company, and I went around the Philippines and basically with a guy who could take down affidavits, and we went to all the different places that Stephen Wong had supposedly been, and we got retractions from all these different people that said, no, I never saw the doctor said, no, I never saw the body, and the cremator said, no, I never signed that. And so I gave all that to the Department of Justice. A warrant was issued for Stephen Wong, and we knew that he was being kept abreast of things here in where he was in Hong Kong, so we had deduced by that time that he was warm walking in Hong Kong. So he knew when that warrant would come down in Hong Kong, and he would be liable for arrest. So I staked out the ferry terminal to Macau. He had very, very good contacts in Macau. We deduced that he'd be headed for Macau, and actually I saw him.
How long after he died? In 92 he died, supposedly.
Yeah.
When did you see him?
September, I think it was 15th, 1993.
Really?
Heading over to Macau.
Were you doing this in the capacity as a journalist?
Yeah, I was on an article for Saturday Night Magazine. I was a contributed editor at Saturday Night Magazine.
But the insurance company, they refused to pay out the policy, right?
That's right.
So how were they involved with your investigation?
They They were basically just there to give me information if I needed it, and also as a method of contact, so that they could set me up with somebody who wouldn't kill me when I got over there and start asking questions. For instance, they had some honest contacts in Philippine law enforcement who would bodyguard me when I went into these very dangerous areas.
Do you think that Stephen Wong is alive today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he is. Well, we know that because after the Department of Justice took 6 months to issue a warrant for his arrest, and he escaped again, and then we know now that he went back to the Philippines, where he was investigated for drug trafficking for 2 years. Then he went to Cambodia, I got a contract with Random House to write a book about all this, and I basically got on his trail again in 1999 and traced him through all these countries. There were six of them that he was operating out of. He wound up back in the Philippines, and he actually wound up becoming a confidential agent for the very police that had once investigated him.
Really?
Worked basically above the law. You know, they have a saying over there for officials, the salary is low, but the income is high, right?
Right.
And the world of corruption over there is that the rise to power is always accompanied by the return of favors. And gangsters like Steve get their favors returned in the currency of impunity. So in countries like the Philippines and Cambodia, Steve and his triad were very deep, well ensconced with the ruling political parties in there, and organized crime is really a licensing system. So the rulers essentially allow lawlessness to take place within the law, and they get their kickbacks. And unfortunately, there's an end to this story. What happened was, while tracking all these, I got an affidavit on the investigation of him in the Philippines. We knew he was alive, but our Canadian Department of Justice has a rule that if a gangster's on the run for 10 or more years, they reassess his case and they figure out whether it's worth the time or expense to keep the file active, and whether or not, if they did arrest him, he likely be convicted. Now, so many years had gone by with him as a successful fugitive, they said, well, we don't think this is worth it anymore to get this guy. And right now, Canada considers heroin trafficking to be a victimless crime. So on December 3rd, 2003, they stayed his charges. And then a year later, they dropped his charges. So he's free to come back here and do his evil deeds again.
So do they think, though, governments, whether here or in Asia, think that he's alive?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
He's on Interpol's most wanted list, is he not?
Well, he was. He was on Interpol's most wanted list for 11 years. But when the Canadian Department of Justice dropped his charges, they took him off. He's a free man.
So did you think he could come back to Vancouver?
Oh, yeah. I know he will. He will. His parents are still here.
And did you think he'll be friends with him again if you ever see him?
Well, I'd like to shake his hand. Maybe we could start all over again.
Really? Finally, I want to ask about, you talked about the Department of Justice taking six months to extradite Wong after you first saw him.
To issue a request for extradition, yeah.
Right, and then the judge giving his passport back.
Steve was identified in Macau by informants, and he was also identified by his former boss in the triad. Steve had been having an affair with his boss's wife. So he was verifiably working in Macau's Lisboa Hotel, but yet the Department of Justice took 6 months to issue a request for extradition.
Do you think this reflects on the Canadian justice system at all?
Yeah, it does. In fact, there are so many incidents like this in our justice system that the anecdotes you hear from police I think, are would serve as formal surveys. I mean, that they're not just anecdotes and gossip. Things like, we have to stop giving fugitives impunity by dropping the charges after so many years. When somebody evades trial by jumping bail, we should never give up pursuing them overseas. There's no home free for Canadian gangsters. If you go to Interpol's website, they specifically address this issue, that, and yet we have this policy for drug traffickers because we consider drug trafficking a victimless crime. And they have well heard of this over in Asia. We're a favorite destination for organized crime groups. If you go to places in Manila, in certain neighborhoods there, like Quiapo, they have storefronts there where they formally print out court judgments in our city papers like bargains in Mexico. And show them to organized crime members to, because they run these storefronts, and they say Vancouver is a good place to go. And the next day we see him here. So I mean, the police are well aware of this. It just we don't realize how organized crime is. That these guys are international, and they look for the place of least resistance. We've got this huge U.S. market next door to us. Why would you operate out of the United States, where you're looking at 75-year prison terms, when you could operate in out of Canada, where we have lower prison, much, one-fifth, we sentence criminals to one-fifth the time they do in the United States. If you even get time, and we have very lenient bail conditions, so you could jump bail. So basically, Canada around the world is famous as a place to set up a criminal enterprise. In fact, there are corrupt lawyers in Canada that recommend to their clients that criminals come to Canada and set up their business. It was just a bust of a money laundering operation in Toronto, and the RCMP guy said, the undercover agent said that the lawyer told them, you should come to Canada because he thought he was a gangster because our prison sentences are so laughable.
It's a fascinating story, and I have to say, I'm Filipino, so the last part of the book where you're trying to talk to Lex and to get information about Wong during a trip to the Philippines was just riveting stuff.
Well, the Philippines, unfortunately, right now is headed over a cliff again, and they were when all the time I'm working on this, but that's an unending story of tragedy. The president of the Philippines was just caught on tape trying to fix her last election.
Right.
And her family was just caught in taking the proceeds from illegal gambling. So you're going to look at some headline stuff coming out of the Philippines very, very quickly. And that stuff was going on all through the time I was looking at Stephen Wong, and over in the Philippines trying to get him from 1999 to 2003. And it's a continuing story of betrayal and tragedy over there.
And one thinks that the Stephen Wong story is unending in itself.
Yeah, it reflects exactly what's going on in the world.
Terry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joseph.
And I enjoyed the book. The book is called Paper Fan, The Hunt for Triad Gangster Stephen Wong. It's published by Vintage, a division.